This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. To make a movie, you need people with specialized talents. You need set decorators, cinematographers, stunt people, dialogue coaches. The filmmakers of the new movie Seabiscuit had a special requirement. They needed a thoroughly convincing star jockey, and they found him in three-time Kentucky Derby winner and horse-racing Hall of Famer Gary Stevens. Stevens plays the role of the Iceman, legendary jockey George Wolfe, in the film. As if his other credits weren't enough to qualify him for the part, in 1996 he received the George Wolfe Memorial Jockey Award at Santa Anita Racetrack for his outstanding achievement in the sport. This is Stevens' first movie role. He's the author of a memoir of his career in horse racing called The Perfect Ride. It's now out in paperback. In the book Seabiscuit, author Laura Hillenbrand writes that Red Pollard was not a great jockey, but on that particular horse, he was a genius. I asked Gary Stevens to talk about the special connection between a rider and his mount.
You know, that's the amazing thing about horse and jockey. There's definitely a communication between horse and jockey, and I've ridden several horses throughout my career that may or may not have responded to me as well as somebody else, and they turn out to be great horses. And I can really sense when I ride a horse and that horse has not given me its best effort, and it may be a case of the horse has a totally different attitude than I have, and I believe that there is a definite mix. And Red Pollard was a guy that you know, just hooked up with Seabiscuit. Whatever he thought, the horse was thinking. And I know that sounds far-fetched, but I've lived it. I've climbed on horses who had bad records, and, you know, I get on their back, and something happens, something magical. And I think that, you know, that's exactly what happened with Red Pollard and Seabiscuit.
I want to talk to you about how jockeys communicate while racing on the track. Because I was watching the film, and in the film you play George Wolfe, and Red Pollard is they're racing, and you talk to each other while you're riding. You have a little conversation, and that seems so preposterous to me. Can you talk, or would you talk to another jockey during a race?
Well, I'll give you an example. I was racing at Del Mar yesterday here in Southern California. And Pat Valenzuela, one of the leading jockeys in the nation, came into the jockey's room and he said, Gary, he said, I saw the film last night. I loved it. Congratulations, so on and so forth. And we went out for the first race, and it was a mile and 3/8 on the turf course, racing on the grass. And we both were on speed horses. We knew that we were both going to be forwardly placed in the race. And we had about 3/4 of a mile left to run in the race. We'd just turned into the backstretch, very similar to the opening scene with Toby and I. And Patrick was on the inside. We were going head and head, and he looked over at me and he says, "I got $5. Says I beat you." And I told him, I said, "I got $10. Says you don't have the $5 to beat me." And he started laughing, and I looked over at him again and I said, "So you going tonight?" We basically recited some lines that were in the film, and we were both going way too fast for the distance of the race. I mean, we couldn't slow our horses down. They were unmanageable, and I think he sensed the same thing that I sensed, that we weren't going to be around at the finish. Our horses were going to run out of gas before we turned into the home stretch. And, you know, we spend long, long days in the jockey's room. We have no season. It's a year-round sport, and we spend sometimes 16, 17-hour days from the time we get up working horses until we go home at night. And if we can lighten a situation up a little bit to make our day go a little easier, we try and do it.
Mm-hmm. Are there situations, though, or is there a code of honor among jockeys about what you do communicate to each other during a race and what you don't? for instance, you don't gang up on someone?
Well, you're not going to hear a lot of communication in the Kentucky Derby, I can tell you that right now. And you're not going to hear a lot of communication through the final stretch in any race. The code of ethics with us jockeys is when we go into a turn, a lot of times we've got a blind spot. When I'm on the outside going into the turn and I've got somebody up inside of me a half a length and I'm three horse widths off of the inside rail and somebody has run up inside of that jockey inside of me, I'm blinded or obscured from that jockey who's run up inside of me. So if I'm traveling at 46 miles an hour and I drop into the turn and I bump the horse inside of me, those bumps aren't small. They're big bumps. And if the passageway that new jockey is trying to fill up is narrow and I take that space away from him, there's going to be a bad wreck. So the jockey to the inside of me, it's his job basically to let me know, hey, you don't have room to drop over, or I've got somebody running up inside of me, things like that.
What part of your body when you're riding is actually touching in contact with the horse?
My feet, obviously in the stirrups, the insides of my feet, and all the way up to about 2 inches below my knees on the inside of my legs, and my hands. Those are the only parts of my body that are in contact during the actual running of the race. I'm not sitting in the saddle. I'm balanced on the balls of my feet. The way that the classic style of an American jockey is to basically stick his toes in the stirrups, the stirrup at an angle, so the outside of the stirrup is just above your little toe. Actually, you're riding on four toes and the ball of your foot underneath your big toe, and that's it.
So if that's all that's maintaining contact with the horse, what keeps your balance? What keeps you in your seat?
It's basically anybody who's ever ridden a jet ski, watercraft. It's a lot the same. You keep your center of balance in the middle of the horse. You keep your heels down, and the weight. Your weight perfectly balanced to where you don't move. The ideal riding style, the way I was taught from my father, who never rode a race and has never ridden a racehorse, but his ideal style of watching a jockey was to be able to set a glass of champagne in the middle of his back at 40 miles an hour and not spill a glass, a drop of that champagne. My job is to move from my shoulders up. Only my arms are to move. Everything else has to sit as quiet as a church mouse, and just not interfere with the horse's action.
And when you say not interfere with the horse's action, that means once you've directed the horse to go a certain way, to either hold him back or let him loose, but not to distract him?
My whole job is to make the horse happy. A happy horse performs well for you. A mad horse won't perform for you. And the legendary jockey, Bill Shoemaker, I had the great chance to spend about 10 years riding with him. And he told me I was about, I guess, 21 years old. He said the secret to being a successful jockey is don't get in their way. I've yet to see a loose horse get beat in a race. When a jockey falls off at the start of a race, 9 times out of 10, the loose horse winds up winning the race, going wide. I know he's not packing the same weight that the rest of them are, but that horse's true natural stride is getting him around the racetrack. So if a horse is packing a sack of potatoes that is flopping all over the place, a 50-pound sack of potatoes that's flopping everywhere. And then you get another horse and you strap 50 pounds on to the horse's back that's not moving. The one that's carrying the 50 pounds that's not moving is going to win every time. So you just try and stay out of their way and sit as still as you can. And when they start the tire, I become the horse's strength. That's when I start picking their head up and pumping my arms and giving them the confidence that I'm there with them. That's when it becomes a team effort.
Well, it's interesting. In your memoir, you write that a rider's confidence in a horse can make the difference between winning big races and getting beaten. So how is that confidence communicated, besides the obvious, the shouting or, I guess, the whip?
I believe that there's a sixth sense that a horse has, and it's almost a telepathy thing. When I have a great relationship with a racehorse, I'm moving along, and we're making split-second decisions. And nine times out of ten, if a hole opens up on the fence for me, on the rail for me, say I'm laying third, and an opportunity comes, and another opportunity happens at the same time to come around, if I've had to think about the decision, am I going in or am I going out? It's too late. That hole is gone. So you react. And nine times out of ten, the horses that I really have a good relationship with, they're moving towards my decision at the exact same time that I'm pointing that horse at that particular opportunity that I have. And, you know, that people have said that over the years that horses are unintelligent. They're stupid animals. To me, a horse is the most intelligent animal that there is out there. When a horse doesn't respond to you, it's usually because you've got some negative stuff going on, you know, inside or outside of the racing game.
Now, I think a race for you really starts before the race, when you first get on the horse. Do you feel the horse out before the race and look for clues about the animal's mood?
Yeah, I mean, that's more or less a trainer's job to let me know. If I've never been on the horse for a morning workout or anything like that, say I fly into New York to ride a big race on a horse I've never seen before, you're a little bit of a hired gun. They're hiring me to come in and ride this big race. I've never seen the horse before, but I do have access to tapes of the horse's previous races. I've got the Daily Racing Form, which is tells all of the horse's past performances, what his running style is. But I rely on the trainer's knowledge to let me know if there's any idiosyncrasies about the horse, things he doesn't like. I don't necessarily want to be told how to ride the horse, but I want to know if he'll come through on the rail, if he prefers to be on the outside, he doesn't like dirt in his face, you know, don't be strong on his mouth, he's got a very light mouth. Those are the things I want to know prior to riding the horse. And once I'm legged up and I walk on the racetrack, I've got 12 minutes to get to know that horse before I get to the starting gate. And usually within about a minute and a half, you've got a pretty good idea of that horse's mental attitude. If he's an aggressive horse or if she's a laid-back kind of horse, how she wants to be treated, how he wants to be treated. And to me, 90% of winning a race is getting to the starting gate and having that horse happy when I go into the stalls. If I've got a horse that's upset and has not handled the pre-race warm-up well, then they normally perform how they warm up. If they're in a bad mood or they get hot and they're aggravated at something, whatever the reason may be, that's usually how they race.
Now, you go into a race with a strategy, but I imagine once you're racing, you have to evolve. Your strategy has to change and adapt to whatever's going on the track, right? Do you end up going through two or three strategies in a race?
It's very similar to the acting with Seabiscuit. When you go in to do a scene, the script is there, your lines are there for you, and there are several different ways of saying those particular lines that may imply different things. You may try and get a totally different point across saying the exact same lines, and it all depends on what the director wants from you, is what he goes with, but you prepare for every one of those different scenarios. And it's the same for me riding a horse race. I've got every horse in a particular race. I've got all of those horses, past performances, and I've done my homework prior to going out and riding a race. I know what all of my competition, what their running styles are, and I know most of the other jockeys, what their riding styles are. So I'll prepare for four or five different scenarios in a given race. For instance, if I'm riding a horse that likes to lay third or fourth, two lengths off the lead, I'll pick out, you know, a couple horses I think that are going to be in front of me. Well, one of those horses that I think is going to be in front of me might stumble leaving the gate. So that, and he's out of the race. That changes the whole makeup of the race. My horse that I'm riding may be very keen that day. He may want to show more speed than he has shown in the past, and I've got to be prepared for that.
When trainers and jockeys talk about strategy, often they talk about holding the horse back. You have to hold the horse back until you let the horse break. Can you describe for us what that feels like? How much of your energy during a race is devoted to holding the horse back?
A lot. You're basically, if that is what is required of the particular horse, first of all, people need to understand that horses are athletes. And if you can imagine a human being, a long-distance runner, racing Carl Lewis, Carl Lewis running 3 miles. Well, Carl Lewis is going to win the first 100 yards or 100 meters, obviously, but he's not going to be around at the end of the marathon because he possibly, I shouldn't say that, Carl, because I don't know that, but you've got to ration your speed. And a lot of the horses are very, very aggressive. I might be in a race that is a mile and 1/8, and my horse is very aggressive. He wants to show all of his speed early on. The race is not won at the start, it's won at the finish. So it's my job to ration that speed. And a lot of these horses are very, very aggressive in their manner. And when a horse is pulling on you, and I'm using three fingers on each hand in my, you know, I've got the reins in three fingers is what I ride with. And when they pull, they pull. I've got calluses on my hands that look like probably a bricklayer or a plumber or something like that. And it tires you out if you've got one pulling. And then, you know, you shift modes halfway through the race. You go from restraining to encouraging. And anyone who has watched a big race on TV or has watched Seabiscuit, the last quarter of a mile is it's a thing of beauty.
Are you aware of the noise of the crowd at the home stretch?
No. Very, very rarely. If I'm winning a race, very easily, say I'm 10 lengths clear of the rest of the field, then I become aware of the crowd. But one thing sticks out in my mind more than anything that's ever happened in my career, one of the greatest moments I've ever experienced was the last 16th of a mile in the Kentucky Derby in 1988 when I won on the filly winning colors. I think there were 128,000 people there that day. And the last 16th of a mile took just over 6 seconds. And those 6 seconds was like an eternity. And it was like slow motion. And I remember not being able, I mean, hindsight, I can't remember hearing the crowd. I could hear my horse breathing. I could hear myself breathing, but I couldn't hear the crowd. And that was quite an experience to remember.
How many injuries have you had? Could you catalog them for us?
Wow. I've had both shoulders reconstructed, screws in each shoulder from subluxing dislocations, if you will, and rotator cuff injuries. Right knee operated on 11 times, left knee 3 times. Shattered right wrist with a plate and 6 screws in it. Broken ankle, broken clavicle on each side 4 times. Tell me when to stop, because I could go on and on. I've been busted up quite a bit.
Well, what was your worst accident?
1985, actually a morning workout accident, a lot like Red Pollard suffered just prior to the big match race in 1938. I was doing a favor for a friend in the morning. An old trainer had 2 or 3 horses, and I had really just started to reach the upper echelon of the racing scene. And old buddy of mine asked me if I'd work this horse in the morning, and I went to the starting gate. It was about 8 o'clock in the morning, I guess, and it was a young horse. And with young horses, you have to get them approved out of the starting gate by a racing official before they can race their first out. So I was getting this young horse approved out of the gate, and we came out of the gate, and my horse just made a left-hand turn with me after about, probably 50 yards, and she was already at top speed when she did this, and she hit the rail with her chest head-on, and it catapulted me into the rail, and I woke up about 18 hours later with my arm in a sling, my leg in a splint, and I didn't know where I was, what had happened, and after about 20 minutes of me waking up, the doctor asked me if I knew what had happened, and I said, yeah, my horse made a half-hand turn out of the hate. And he looked at my wife at the time and said, does your husband have a speech impediment? And she said he never did before, and that's the most scared I've ever been in my life. I couldn't talk. My shoulder was completely torn apart, and my right knee was basically destroyed, and they told me I would never ride again, and I was back in the saddle 5 months later.
Do you feel fear when you're riding?
No. I would be lying if I said that that we don't think about it. I've had good friends killed. We just... Lafitte Penkai, winningest jockey of all time and one of the greatest athletes of all time, as far as I'm concerned, was just forced into retirement after just an incredible career. He had a terrible fall in February and broke his neck. Was in a halo for 3.5 months, and the doctors basically told him if... he suffered another fall like he had, he was either going to die or he was going to be a quadriplegic. So I think all of our biggest fear is not really death, but paralysis. But as I said before, you take educated risks. You don't do anything stupid, and you don't want to surround yourself around stupid jockeys. Because if the guy in front of you does something stupid and he falls, it's a chain reaction. If the guy kills himself by doing something stupid, that's fine if he's an idiot. But don't take 5 of my friends with you, pal. So use your head when you're out there, you know. That's kind of our thinking when we go out to ride a race.
So it sounds like you have fears when you're not on the track. In a quiet moment, or I don't know when, but once you're racing, that's not the emotion that you experience.
Yeah, I mean, there's a scene in the film where I'm going in to see Red Pollard after he's had this horrible accident. And the look on my face when I'm walking in to the hospital is, even to myself watching it, a pretty disturbing look. I won't go to a hospital. I've spent a huge amount of time of my life in a hospital. And I hate the smell of a hospital. I don't like to see a person in pain, especially a friend, a colleague. And everyone knows that, and I'm not the only one, there are several guys, jockeys, that just superstition, whatever. I won't go in a hospital to see a jockey that's fallen. I might go in there to see grandma or mom and dad, but I'm not going into the hospital to see a jock that has fallen. Bad karma.
Well, how much pain are you in when you ride?
I retired in 1999 because of my knee pain. And, you know, I was taken care of by the best orthopedic surgeons in the United States time and time again. And I kept watching these football games, and they'd say so-and-so has had arthroscopic surgery on his knee. He's going to be back in 14 days and this and that. So I'd get these arthroscopic surgeries, go in and clean out some meniscus. Basically, you go in for a Jiffy Lube, they're cleaning out the knee, and you're back in action in 3 weeks. And I believed that. I really never ever gave myself a chance to heal up. Being at the competitive business that it is, there are 20 other guys out there that have as much talent as I do, riding wise, and so I'm going to protect my business. Every day that I miss, I'm missing mounts and a possible Derby contender. So you don't want to be gone. And I would rush back as soon as I could without healing up properly. And when I retired in 99, it was just because of chronic knee pain, degenerative arthritis in my right knee. And after my retirement, I started a whole new rehab program for my knees. And I was out for 11 months, and I came back. And I've cut down on the number of mounts that I ride every year. I try and hold it every week. I used to ride 35, 40 horses races a week, and now I ride maybe a busy week, maybe 15 races a week. So I've cut back dramatically, and I try and just ride the best races in the country instead of riding every day. And, you know, as long as I can do that, my career is going to last a little bit longer, and I can deal with the little bit of pain that I have on the odd day. But same thing. You can deal with a little bit of pain, and when you're coming through the stretch, riding a horse that you feel this power, and their stride is 22 feet long, it makes you forget about the pain.
Can I ask you what you weigh when you're racing?
113 pounds is what I weigh dripping wet when I'm racing. I've got the day off today, and I weigh about 117 pounds.
So how many times a day do you weigh yourself?
I weigh myself when I wake up and when I go to bed on my days off. When I'm racing, I'm required to weigh before every race that I ride. And same thing, I weigh myself when I get up. I weigh myself when I go to the locker room, and if I've got a pull some weight, getting in the sauna or whatever, I'll do that and periodically check my weight during my sauna session. If I've got to drop a pound and a half, I'll sit in there until the pound and a half is dropped. But I'm required to weigh before and after every race that I ride to show that I've carried the exact same weight that is required. When I walk out of the jockey's room, when I come back in, I've got to weigh the same weight with my equipment included. And last thing I do when I leave the jockey's room is I weigh myself again, and before I go to bed, I weigh myself again. So I don't know, what's that, maybe 15, 20 times a day of crossing the scales.
Well, all athletes who have to meet their weight, wrestlers and, of course, jockeys, they resort to all sorts of techniques. What are your techniques to keep the weight off?
When I get up in the morning, I have a cup of coffee. Usually have a bagel, something like that. I go to the racetrack. I work horses. And working out the horses, I usually lose from 2 to 3 pounds, which allows me to eat a decent lunch. I don't like eating any sooner than an hour before I ride. And I just try and keep myself full of fluids throughout the day when I'm racing. And if I've ridden 5 or 6 races, I've usually lost another 2 pounds, and I'm pretty much able to eat what I want to at night. You get to a certain stage in life, and it becomes easier. I mean, my body has adapted to eating less. I'm very, very healthy. When I retired in 1999, I got up to, I think, 131 pounds, and I was so uncomfortable. I was sluggish. I didn't have any energy. And I got back down to, like, 121 was where I was most comfortable. And, I hated being overweight. And I have very little body fat. Therefore, I've got a lot of energy, and I feel like going all the time.
I'm talking with jockey Gary Stevens. Now, you grew up on a farm in Boise, Idaho. Your father had a training barn. Were you just constantly with the horses as a kid?
No, not really. I had a bad fall when I was 6 years old on one of my mother's horses. And I was scared to death of horses from like age 6 until I guess I was about 11. And my brother, Scott, who's older than me and is also a professional jockey in the Midwest, I idolized him. He taught me everything I know about riding, and he had just started to ride races, and I thought, well, that looks fun. That looks like something I want to do. And I got on one of my dad's racehorses at, the recommendation from my brother to my father said, hey, this horse is easy to get on in the morning. He'll teach Gary something. And I felt the strength and the power of this thoroughbred racehorse. His name was Golden Ribbon. And I was hooked. That was it. I knew what I wanted to do.
Well, you left home at 16. You didn't finish school to start racing competitively. Why were you in such a rush?
I guess being naive. I don't know if I had it to do over again, even with the way that my career has turned out. Had I known how lucky I was going to have to be to get the breaks that I've been given, or earned, or however you want to say it, and look back at the injuries and everything else, there's no way that I would have chosen this path. I'm glad I did choose it, but had I not been naive and thought that I just assumed everything was going to turn out great. I've always been a positive thinker, and when you start out as a professional jockey, you start at the age of 16. You get your apprenticeship at 16, and you keep your apprenticeship for 100 wins or a year, whichever comes last. And so I had my apprenticeship for a year and became a full-fledged professional jockey. But you never know. People thought I was going to get too big to be a jockey. You don't know how long you're going to last, and if you're ready for it, you just pursue it. That's what I did.
Funny Side was the famous horse that everyone was rooting for this year. Now, you rode in the Belmont Stakes with Funny Side. You weren't on Funny Side. You were riding a horse called Scrimshaw. But did you did a part of your heart root for Funny Side? Does that happen?
You know, I've been in that same situation. I was riding Silver Charm in 1997, going for the Triple Crown win. One of my best friends beat me in the final strides, Chris McCarron. He beat me on a horse named Wild Rush. And the following year, as close as I've ever come to the perfect ride, was the Belmont Stakes, real quiet, owned by one of my best friends, Mike Pagram, was going for the Triple Crown. And it was a $5 million bonus. And, you know, I'd been in that situation the year before with Silver Charm. And you go out there, and if I can be the one to spoil it, it's really sick, but if I can be the one that spoils it, I want to be the spoiler. But if I can't be the one to win, then I'm definitely rooting for history to be made. And I wind up beating my best friend's horse in the last stride. And it wasn't even the money. It was the chance at history. And it was bittersweet for me. I mean, I loved winning. It was a great payday, but it wasn't about the money. It was about a chance like Funny Side had this year. And I'll tell you, the same thing happened this year. When I walked out of the jocks room, I wished Jose Santos good luck. And I said, pal, if I can't beat you, I hope you win it. I said, I'd love to see history made. So, yeah, I guess we root a little bit.
I have to ask you this. Do you ride for pleasure?
No. No, I do not. And I might like it, but, you know, when I've been doing this for 23 years, and the last thing I want to do on my day off is go get on a horse and do it for pleasure. I suppose if, you know, it was beautiful scenery and I was in the right company, I would like it, but my days off, I mount up on my Harley-Davidson motorcycle and take off on that kind of journey.
And that's that much different, huh?
Yeah. Horsepower, still horsepower, though. Different kind of horsepower.
Well, Gary Stevens, I want to thank you very much for talking today.
Barbara, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Gary Stevens' memoir is called The Perfect Ride. He's in the new film Seabiscuit in the role of jockey George Wolfe.